offering a most loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet. Dear listeners, we welcome you to this week's episode of Afternoon Satsang. As always, joining you from our studios at the Sri Sathya Sai Media Center, Mrs. Prem, and with me is Arvind. And we have the pleasure of thinking of Swami for the next 1.5 hours and having your company when you're doing that. Indeed, there is so much that we can think about, so much that we can give our mind space to. Swami has given us this opportunity to sit and think about Him. In the multitude of thoughts that we could have, Swami has given us an opportunity where we can think of things which are related to Swami in so many ways. And this is the week where we do that by going through the Sanatan Sarthi. A beautiful walk down the memory lane. We are going through the Sanatan Sarthi of the first year of its launch, 1958. We are still in the September issue. We did a few entries which are there in this issue last week. We are here to continue and complete that. It's a period where Swami traveled extensively. Swami was drawing a lot of people to Him who had their own skepticism, who had their own journeys. And all of that in a certain sense is reflected in these articles and the travels and the events which happened. So it is indeed so beautiful to travel with Swami back into those times. And before we embark on that journey again this week, let's invite Arvind to join all of us. Sairam Arvind.
Sairam Prem and Sairam to all our listeners. As Prem put it, this was a period when a lot of people got to know Swami, came to Swami. Swami also traveled. We had spoken in detail last week about Swami's visit to East Godavari, Rajahmundry, and the beautiful experiences that happened there. I think we also spoke about Swami Karunyananda, right, how He came to Bhagwan and continued to stay till 1997. This week we will be going through the September 1958 issue, where there are two people who again got to know Swami during this time. One is a certain Challa Appa Rao, the other is Yogiraj Bua. Both of them have had amazing experiences, and the way they came to Swami is beautiful. And having come to Swami, they have also contributed to the Sanatan Sarthi articles. It was really enlightening, uplifting, and wonderful to read through and build a picture of their experiences. And I'm sure we will be trying our best to recreate the same for all of you, dear listeners, as we go through today's Afternoon Satsang. We will begin with an article by Challa Appa Rao. He has written an article called Swami, the Incarnation of God. And in that he writes briefly about how he came to Swami first time in 1955 when he heard about Swami. But when he heard about Swami, he was not very impressed. As he himself confesses in the article, he had his own thoughts and notions which he had gathered by reading many books, spiritual books. He says that there was a lot of indifference in his head towards Swami. So the first time he came to Swami, there was nothing much that he expected from Swami or he thought would happen. He just came out of idle curiosity, and he, as he puts it, he was preoccupied in his own thoughts and books. And because of that preoccupation, he was blind to all that was happening around him. He confesses it there. You know, it's such a common experience for all of us. When we are preoccupied in our mind, something might happen right before our eyes and we would have been totally blind to it. Or somebody may tell something to us and we'll be totally deaf to it. It only makes it very clear that the sense organs, which are our eyes, ears, nose, skin and tongue, they are not the one that are actually perceiving. The one who perceives is deep within. And yes, I will not go more into that, but that is what happens to us in common experience. And he says that reading too many other books, reading so many other thoughts, made me impervious to what was happening around me. I just felt that this is so important, because there are times, you know, when we come across things that are critical of Bhagwan, negative about Bhagwan, possibly on the internet, in books, or people speaking. And I have committed the mistake of, you know, thinking that I have had so much experience with Swami, I am so firmly rooted in Swami, let me see what these naysayers or negative people are telling, so that, you know, I can actually convert them or change them, or, you know, I can easily respond to each of those queries. While in most cases, I am able to generate responses or, you know, stave them off, fight them off. At the end of it, I definitely am not feeling so good myself. You know, it's like a war. You might actually wage a war and win it, but you are also, even though you're a victor in the war, you are affected. That's why there is that saying which goes that there are no true victors in a war. Because apparently, technically, somebody wins, somebody loses, but both have lost a lot. And that is what came in my mind when I read this. He says that he was so preoccupied in his thoughts and books that he was blind to all that was happening around. And at the same time, while this was the case, there was something that happened at a very deep level, unconsciously, which made him yearn and crave, and that is the reason he came back for a second time as well as a third time.
Right. In fact, the way he puts it about reading books, I think the way he has analyzed what is happening inside his mind itself shows that he is a pretty deep person in that sense of trying to observe deeply what is happening inside and his relationship with Swami. So he says that it was quite interesting for him to note that I could think of anything else except the ways of my Lord. Before that he says, I was so indifferent I could go on with my habit of reading books undisturbed. Which means, at a later point also he makes a mention of that. The mind that God has gifted him, he was saying that it leads him to do so many things with such skill, but without his knowledge, it was the same mind which was actually turning him away from God. Right? And as you were saying, all kinds of inputs that we take. I was just listening to a talk by one of our juniors, one of our alumni. He was narrating how he was brought up in a family which was devoted to Swami. From a very young age, a picture of Swami was put in the altar. And, of course, they had also witnessed some miracles and they had come to Swami when Swami had visited their city and all of that. Mm-hmm. Then he's saying somewhere near the teenage, the way he puts it is, my neighbors, uncles, cousins, fathers, grandfathers, to say that somebody so distant comes and tells him that one saint, who, you know, one of the revered saints, has told that those who perform miracles cannot be spiritual. Right? So he's saying that I don't even know who has made that statement, and so distant, but that much was enough to turn me away from Swami at that point in time.
Mm.
Right? That's how our mind is, especially that period, you know, teenage and thereafter, where we think that we know so much, we have gathered enough knowledge to make decisions ourselves. We don't realize, even then we are being influenced by something else. But we are in the illusion that we are taking our own decision.
And that then we are in charge of our lives.
Right, in charge of our lives. And we are making proper discrimination. And I think that is one of the things that he's alluding to here. And the mind can play such a trick on you. Right? And of course, luckily for him, he says that after a few days, there was this craving to come back again after the second darshan, and which didn't make much impression on him. The third was an inherent craving which he could not explain, which brought him to Swami, and thankfully that changed everything.
Absolutely. Reading that, it becomes very clear that Swami's influence on us is something that is beyond the mind, because all these distractions and thoughts happen at the mind level. And despite him being so indifferent for the first time, and he says the second visit was just for a few hours that he had come, despite that he says that because of those two visits, he suddenly developed a craving that he wants to come and have Swami's darshan. Inexplicable. He has not been impressed intellectually or otherwise with anything that has happened around. In fact, he says, forget being impressed. I have not even observed. I have been impervious and blind to them. And yet in me is that craving that I want to have darshan. And in the article, he writes that I had an experience in the hilltop before Shivratri, which completely changed my life. And though he doesn't describe it in this article, what happened is that Swami had gone for a walk on the hill where the general hospital is situated. It's actually on a hill.
Mm-hmm.
And as Swami was walking there, those days Swami would go for walks, evening walks, morning walks, as he pleased. And a few devotees would follow him, that's all.
Mm-hmm.
And this Challa Apparao happened to be one of the devotees who was following. And in fact, he noticed that he was the only devotee who was just walking behind Swami. And Swami was walking amidst some boulders. And Swami suddenly said, "Do you know where is Lord Rama?" He says, "Swami, Lord Rama is was born in Ayodhya and in the Treta Yuga." Swami says, "It is wrong to think that Rama belongs to the Treta Yuga. Rama belongs to all time. He is there everywhere." And even as Swami made that statement, Apar Rao writes that he had a vision of Lord Sri Rama standing there on the hillock. This was a few days before Shivratri. And on the boulder there was Rama with his kodanda, bow, everything. And that darshan just floored him. And moment later, it's all back to normal. And Swami comes back from the walk as if nothing happened. And he writes here that, "I knew after that experience that Swami is Paramatma." In this article, he writes, though he doesn't write about the experience of having that vision. You know, these things, these kind of visions and spiritual experiences are so deep that one needs to spend some time in assimilating and absorbing it. And since this experience had happened to him in 1956 or 57 maybe, it was possibly too early for him to divulge it. And that's why I think he has not written it in this article. But he writes this much very clearly that, "I knew Swami was Paramatma and from then my life changed." He writes that, "It is here I came to know that man is in constant danger of falling a victim to the promptings of avidya." You know, avidya meaning ignorance. And he considers all that he had read in different books and the different conclusions that he had made in his mind as ignorance. You know, this is such an important point because we often think that the only thing to be gained from books and reading is knowledge. No, we may actually gain even ignorance. That's why when Swami says, "Tyaja durjana samsargam," give up bad company, it's not only about people, it's also the books we read, the media we ingest, whatever input that we give to our sense organs, because that's also company. Finally, at a worldly level, our company boils down to our thoughts. In fact, I was reading again one spiritual master saying, why we should do Namasmarana. He was saying that even if we are not in anybody's presence and we are all by ourselves, we are constantly talking to ourselves. And many times we don't have control on what we call as the internal chatter. What we are talking to ourselves, we don't know. It might be actually harmful and negative and it might be bad company. That's why the best way to beat that internal chatter is to do Namasmarana. Think of the name of the Lord. Only positive is associated with it. And that will also ensure that our internal chatter is actually internal satsang. So when he says that, "I came to know that man is in constant danger of falling a victim to the promptings of avidya," it makes it very clear that whatever we gain from books and reading and viewing is not knowledge. We can even gain ignorance through reading.
Then he concludes by saying that, "It was here it became known to me that man knows God only through bhakti based on the performance of karma in a detached way." And again, the essence of what Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita is that, you know, you come to the Lord, it's only through bhakti that you come to know of the Lord. And I think Swami makes this point even in his discourses, where he says there is an internal sadhana and external sadhana. The internal sadhana is that of bhakti, where you try to transform yourself from within. The external sadhana is the karma yoga that you do. You do your duty and you offer it as as part of your worship to the Lord. So both, he says that, you know, and the beauty of the thing is, it is known. It is not that this has not been told before. But in Swami's presence, some of these truths become so real to us, right? When you say that through bhakti you come to know of Swami, it takes a different meaning altogether when you're in Swami's presence. And I think that exhilaration is what is being expressed through this article and these lines he's making here.
In fact, that's where he concludes his article. But I was just trying to read a little bit more about Challa Appa Rao. And in the third part of the Satyam Shivam Sundaram, it is recorded that in 1969, Swami again made a visit to the East Godavari district. So I think last week we were discussing about the 1958 visit to East Godavari, first time possibly Rajamundry and other places. So in 1969, that is 12 years later, and that was the time when Challa Appa Rao was at his hometown of Peddapuram. And again, this Peddapuram was also discussed last week. Right. Swami delivered a discourse there.
Right.
Peddapuram. So at Peddapuram, he was having severe piles, lot of bleeding, because of which his hemoglobin count had fallen to 30% of the normal level. And he had been suffering this from 3 years, and the last 8 months had been very, very severe, because of which he had lost a lot of blood. He had become very weak, fatigued, low hemoglobin count, edema all over the body. His body had swollen up. And there's a Dr. G. Keshav Rao that Professor Kasturi quotes, who advised Challa Appa Rao that if you don't seek medical help now, you will be finished. You will be gone. There is zero chance of survival for you. But Challa Appa Rao, by this time, you know, he has come to Swami. I think it must be about 12 years since he has had his darshan of Swami, 13 years. He's so fixed in his faith, he says, I don't need any doctor. The Lord is my doctor. And he just takes vibhuti and he says, if I need to be cured, Swami will cure me. And he's obstinate in that. So much so, the devotees travel back to Prashanthi Nilayam and complain to Swami about him. And they tell Swami that he's obstinately not taking medicines, nothing. Swami, his end is near. And Swami's response to those complaints are, Swami says, is it that if a person takes medicine, he or she has never gone? Aren't there enough cases where people have taken medicine and yet have gone? And the devotees are just dumbstruck, they don't know what to tell. In fact, Dr. Keshav Rao says that he himself conveyed this to Swami, and this was the reply that Swami gave, saying that, do you think if he takes medicines, he won't die? But then, on the 22nd of January 1969, Swami visited Peddapuram during his travels to East Godavari. And in that, as I said, part 3 of Satyam Shivam Sundaram, the entire detailed travel is there. But on the 22nd of January, Swami arrived at Peddapuram and went straight to Challa Appa Rao's home. And Swami materialized a lingam for him and told him to do Abhishekam with water and drink that water thrice a day as Teertham.
Mm-hmm.
And they say that in a matter of days, 2-3 days time, he recovered his body weight, he got back his vitality, the bleeding stopped, the energy came back, and within 1 month, nobody could even imagine that this person was a patient from 3 years suffering so much from all these bleeding piles, edema, low hemoglobin. Everything cleared. And this was a miracle that got effected in the January of 1969. It just reminds me of the discussion that we read in the conversations with Satya Sai Baba, where Hislop asked Swami, is it really necessary to take medicine or faith is enough? And Swami says that faith is actually enough, but usually such faith, you know, this is what Swami leaves unsaid, usually such faith is difficult to get. That's why there is no harm in praying continuously, but all taking the medicine that the doctors prescribe. Prayer is very important, Swami said back then. But I think Challa Appa Rao was one such devotee who had such faith that the Lord actually traveled to his home and cured him.
Exactly. And, you know, the thing is, sometimes we ourselves don't know whether we are, we have this kind of a faith and we have this kind of surrender to Swami. Apparently when the super specialty hospital was set up in 1991, whenever Swami would speak to some of the office bearers, Swami would tell them that, you know, from especially North Indian states, Swami would say that you should look out for people who need medical help and you should be able to direct them to Prashanthi Nilayam, right? And in your own centers and samitis, if you happen to come across anybody, you should be in a position to guide them. And it has happened over the years, you know, we have a huge patient program which happens in Kerala, in states of Odisha, and especially these places where you have a lot of people coming from there. Mm. The follow-up also happens. So apparently that was initiated by Swami himself. So a lot of these people used to send patients, and I think from Indore or something, one patient had come. And this person has never come to Swami, has never seen Swami. And he goes to the hospital. The doctors, you know, look at him and they say that you need a surgery much sooner than we thought you would need. So it's not advisable that you go away and come back. If you can stay here for a couple of weeks, you stay here. we'll finish the surgery. I said, I don't know anything here. What am I supposed to do here for 1 week? And I can't afford to go and come back within a week. They said, you can go to the ashram. Swami is giving darshan. You can enjoy Swami's darshan for a couple of weeks and then come back and get admitted. So he said, all right. And he went and sat for darshan. And he started enjoying that, of course, the bhajans and all that. And one of those days, apparently, Swami comes up to him and Swami said, what have you come here for? So he said, Swami, I'm a patient. I've come for surgery. And apparently, Swami got very upset. Swami said, the statement that we've heard many times and we've also discussed, where Swami said, for those who have faith in medicine, I've built the hospital. For those who have faith in me, I'm here. So Swami said that statement in Hindi in some form to that person. He said, yeah, if you have faith in doctors, go there. For those who have faith in me, I'm here. Right? And that person said that, then what am I going to the doctor for? When Swami is here, why should I go to the doctor? So he said, I'm not going. So that date where he was supposed to go to the hospital comes and goes by. And finally, the doctor who was supposed to operate on him sees him in the ashram one of those days and says, why didn't you come? We've been waiting for you. You're supposed to come and get admitted. And he says that this is what Swami said. And he said, okay, but as a doctor, my duty is to, follow up with you. So whether you do the surgery or not is your call, but do come by to the hospital. We would like to take a look at you. And then this patient does go back to the hospital. They look at him and they find that there is no sign of that symptom which he had, for which they had to schedule that surgery and to advance the surgery to. It completely become all right. And, sometimes the devotee in you also has to be discovered by Swami and pulled out, not necessarily by the devotee. Chala Apara was a case where the devotee was firm in his resolve, but sometimes, as Swami says, I'm here to discover and pull out that devotee in each one of you. There's so many cases, each devotee has a different journey.
The underlying truth, the underlying thing that we have to take from all this, I feel, is there is nothing like impossible for Swami.
Right.
What you imagine as, maybe we think like that, we think based on the limitation of our own mind. Maybe this much Swami can do, but this is how, that is the reason why, we end up with prayer like, Swami, how is this going to end? Swami, what is going to happen? Because we just cannot imagine any happy ending for a scenario. But the Lord is, when you were speaking about this devotee, I was just reminded how, about a decade ago, more than a decade ago, my father had a severe stroke and heart stroke, and he was just sweating profusely, and he went in the Bombay hospital. They told him that he has had a heart attack and they need to rush him in for surgery. And he called me to tell that, and I was like, let's ask Swami. And I didn't know, because this was probably the first time that I had to take a call on a major medical emergency in the family. Otherwise, every time it's the parents who have been doing.
Right.
So when I felt that we should ask Swami, he agreed, and much against the wishes of the doctor in Bombay, he travelled by flight, came to Puttaparthi, and in Puttaparthi, even before I could tell Swami, he collapsed in the room, and we rushed him to the super speciality hospital here, and the doctor said that he has had a heart attack, we need to do surgery. I was so tense, and I remember when I told this to Swami, in a very casual manner, Swami said, no, that's not heart attack, that's little gas in the stomach. And at that point in time, Prem, really my mind was, Swami, you don't know, Swami, it's a heart attack, But how do I tell this to Swami? I said, Swami, our hospital doctors have said, it's like, Swami, if you don't trust the other hospital, okay. Our hospital doctors said it's heart attack. Swami said, no, it's only gas trouble. Then I said, Swami, what do you want me to do? Swami said, if you want, go to hospital. So that's what I wanted. So we went to the hospital actually.
Mm-hmm.
And, I had written a letter, and it was so sweet that we had this opportunity. Swami used to give this opportunity to all the staff members that with any emergency or any urgent thing, you can actually go and give a letter at the residence, and that letter would be taken to Bhagwan. So I had given a letter like that, saying that, they have taken him in, and it was in progress.
Mm-hmm.
At that point in time, before I could even hear, I forget what, they do a cath procedure to decide where the block is and how they should resolve that.
Right.
They had to see the location of the block. Even as that was going on, I received a call from one of the brothers, Brother Satyajit, who was with Bhagwan. And he told that Swami had told to convey don't do any surgery. As much as possible, medicines should be enough. Then I said, which surgery, brother? Means I had no idea. I said, which surgery? He said, these are Swami's words. No need to do surgery, medicine, as how much ever possible, medicines, make do with medicines. So I said, okay. And I just waited. The doctors came out and they said, yes, there is a block, and they were saying this is there. It's not a very big block, but it's a block nevertheless. It's not in a very big vessel, but it's in a vessel nevertheless, supplying to the heart. And so I was just listening to all that, and they were debating whether the risk of surgery, because it's a small vessel there, not a very important vessel, but again, it's nothing is anything that supplies to the heart, none of them can be said as not important.
Right.
Not the major one, and yet it can cause a problem. So they were debating whether risk of surgery was greater or risk of leaving it without surgery is greater. And you know, as these two doctors, Dr. Iyer and Dr. Panikkar, they're discussing, I walk in between and I say, doctor, you know, let's not do the surgery. Let's just treat it with medicines as much as possible. And they looked at me with, what is this fellow saying like that? Now I can smile at it. But I said, no, sir, this is what Swami has said. This is what I got. The minute they also heard it, experienced experts with 2 decades experience in their field, they both said, that's it then. We are going to treat this case with medicines. And you know, I must say, it's been 11 years now. My father is doing very well. And even to this day, you know, I just can't, in my mind is not able to wrap around the fact that there were 2 heart attacks. And Swami said, no, it's gastric trouble, no need anything. And even now I feel that it was my own lack of faith and confidence, possibly, that Swami said, you know, let him take some medicines and it's okay. Possibly, you know, not possibly, definitely nothing is needed. But as you say, as we have discussed, that faith is so important, and it'll be a great blessing if we can actually develop that faith, because then life will be a smooth ride in the sense that all the bumps and jumps won't affect us. We will be calm and peaceful knowing that our dear Swami is taking care of us.
Right. And I think that was the unique blessing when you have when the avatar is here, right? Many, many occasions we've seen this where it would be a big crisis, but with Swami's words, Swami would just brush it aside. There was one of the old students who narrates, you know, Puttaparthi, as we all know, Puttavardhini was its original name, filled with snakes. Even today, every other day we will find somebody saying that, oh, I saw a snake here, I saw a scorpion there. So they are not coming into our space. We have encroached into their space, so we do find them. So I think there was one student who had a very fatal snake bite once, and they rushed. The doctors who attended to him knew that it was a poisonous snake which had bit, and it was conveyed to Swami, and Swami brushed it aside by saying something like this. He said, no, it's some insect bite or something like that, or saying that it's not at all a snake bite. And you know, sometimes one thing is you want solution to your problem. The other thing is, you know, like a child in the house, you want the attention of the mother. Right. Many times when you cry and go to the mother, yes, or father, it's for the attention that, you know, something has hurt you and you want. So sometimes it's both, you know, Swami is not giving attention to the problem, and you're not getting the attention that
the pampering
that you deserve at that moment. So the student was a little upset. He said, what is this Swami is saying like this? And eventually nothing happened and he came out of that. And then it occurred to him that by saying that it is not a snake bite, Swami had actually protected him from what would have been a snake bite. Right? Even though it was a snake which bit him, he saw the snake, the marks were there on his feet. But by saying that it was not a snake bite, Swami had actually removed that effect which he would have had to suffer and undergo. So I think that is the special blessing that we all have in Swami's, you know, when the avatar is there to make such proclamations and pronouncements to us.
On that note, dear listeners, we'll take a little break here. Many times it so happens that you read something good and with that so many things get elicited. I don't think either Prem or me had planned a 40-minute discussion on this one article by Challa Apparao, but how beautiful it is. That's why good elicits good, bad elicits bad. That's why I keep good company. And we will continue with this good company after this little break, so don't go away anywhere.
Ananda Ram, Ananda Sham.
Welcome back, dear listeners. We just completed one of the articles of the 1958 September issue, and we'll take it forward from there. The other piece which is printed in that issue is a poem by somebody who writes in the pen name Venu. I think there was one article or a poem earlier too by the same person. The name Venu means the flute, so someone has used that as their pen name, not wishing to use their real name. So the poem that he has written is goes like this. The title is Little Great Things. it's not the chain that matters, but every link that makes it. The atom power is greater than all else put together. You'd care for every penny if pounds your needs must gather. To live a life that's worthy, in little things be faithful. To those with trouble burdened, a little understanding with speech that's kind and gentle brings cheer with hope and enlivened. A helping hand that's willing, a timely little action, a little smile that's cheery, are deeds by far the greatest. So a poem on what we refer to as little acts of kindness, right? A very beautiful poem where it says that, you know, a typical mistake that all of us do, concentrate on the bigger picture and forget that the bigger picture is nothing but made of small, as they say, little strokes, make the huge fresco or whatever is that expression where they say. That's what we often forget, and often, you know, it's a very beautiful and lovely experience to see an artist's painting that for a long time you will not make out what the final picture is. And finally, when you look at it, it's all small strokes which make that beautiful picture. And nowadays, in social media like Twitter and Instagram, you always find these artists putting their time lapse of their painting. Right? Mm. It's so beautiful to see, but it finally comes down to the ability to make those perfect circles and perfect straight lines. Right? That's all you need to master. And of course, putting it together, it's a creative experience altogether.
In fact, when you speak of painting, I'm reminded of a beautiful TED talk that I saw and I keep seeing repeatedly on YouTube. It's called How to Achieve Your Most Ambitious Goals by a person called Stephen Dunier, how you pronounce it, I don't know. It's so amazing, and it literally starts like how you said, you know, he puts up a black and white painting of a very famous movie personality and asks how many of you in the audience can paint this. Nobody raises their hand. Because nobody can paint that. It's so beautiful. In fact, when you look at it, you don't even think it's a painting. You think it's a photograph, possibly.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, I can teach you how to do this in 15 minutes. Not even 15 minutes. In less than a minute, I can teach it to you. Would you like to learn? And then, you know, he starts zooming into that picture, zooming in. And he says, how many of you can paint this gray square? One small gray square. And that's very simple, you know, just have to draw a square and just paint gray in it. And he says, now this, as we start going out, you know, gray squares, different gray squares of different grayness, nothing but he's actually showing us one pixel in that same painting. And as you zoom out, you see all those pixels, that is what is making up that entire painting. And he says that you might say that this is not painting, but then he gives examples of, example of an artist who is earning millions of dollars, is a very rich, very well-known artist who does his painting exactly in this manner. Just picks it up and breaks it down to pixels and goes ahead doing it. And then, you know, he, this Stephen Dunier, he shares his own life wherein he was not extremely, I cannot say he was not a bright student. He was intelligent, but, you know, he would say that always his teachers would say that he's intelligent, but he can do better. You know, he says he was not able to focus on anything for a long period in time. And that's why he says it began with him thinking that I will study, I'm not able to sit for long, but 5 minutes I will study. And then take a break, go dribble the basketball, come back, 5 minutes I'll study. So he says that he broke down academics into bite-sized parts, you know, like five-minute studies, that's it.
Mm-hmm.
And he says in a matter of 2 years, he topped his university, he went on to study, get the most prestigious scholarships. And he says that ever since then, he has started using this principle wherein he breaks down anything complex into small, bite-sized, manageable portions. And just focuses on doing those portions at a time. And I will not go into repeating that whole 19-minute talk by myself. I would definitely encourage and egg all our listeners to go and watch the talk, How to Achieve Your Most Ambitious Goals, a TED Talk by Stephen Dunier. It's amazing the things that he has accomplished by simply breaking down big things into small tasks. And I think that is the message that is also being amplified in this poem, wherein he says that spirituality or achieving God or divinity it looks like a real big task, but break it down into simple little kind acts, small acts. A smile at someone, a helping hand, you know, somebody's carrying something, just help to carry that a little bit. You never know, you know, because a little kindness can go a long way. In fact, I'm tempted to share something that I read long back in that popular book called Chicken Soup for the Soul.
Mm-hmm.
In that, there's a story of how there was this rabbi who used to always wish everybody whom he meets on the road with a good morning, with a cheerful smile. And it so happens that the World War II begins and the area has been conquered by the German Nazi forces. And there, you know, finally all the Jews have been rounded up, and this rabbi, rabbi included, and they're now in a line. They're going where there's a person standing there who is deciding whether you go left to the gas chambers or right back to your life, you know. And interestingly, or and coincidentally, I don't think it's a coincidence. There are no coincidences in the universe. It's all, you know, miracles where God has remained anonymous. That's all. When it comes to his turn, the person standing there and deciding, that German soldier or German officer, whoever he is, he has been one of the recipients of his daily good mornings, every day, you know. And when he sees a rabbi, something happens in his heart and he just tells him, right, you know, and makes him go to right to his life back. I mean, not to the gas chambers. So, this is to say that even a small thing like a good morning, you know, a good morning, a small act of kindness can go a long way in coming back to you. You know, in all other cases, maybe it doesn't come back to you as blatantly as it happened in this case, but it definitely comes back. And that's why in this poem he says, a helping hand that's willing, a timely little action, a little smile that's cheery, these deeds by far are the greatest, because they are the building blocks of the great edifices that we are thinking of building.
Right, and a very beautiful reminder of that, as Swami would often say, and we all know the famous story that we've quoted so many times, and especially very Professor Venkatraman used to be very fond of this, the story of Al Honig, where, you know, he narrates this in his own words in one of his talks, where he comes back from his visit to Prashanti Nilayam, and he's wondering, you know, what is it that I can do? You know, I've seen Swami. Swami has come into my life. What is it that I can do? And I'm such a small person. Is there anything that I can do to express myself? And I'm not getting those words. Maybe sometime we'll have to quote that. Very beautiful conversation where he comes and he asks Swami what he can do. And Swami says, do something small. You know, anything small is acceptable to me, or something. I'm not quoting it verbatim. A very simple interaction in the interview room with Swami. So he goes back, and that's when he decides that he'll just make sandwiches and hand them out in the suburbs and in the subways, where a lot of homeless people would be there.
He's from New York.
Right, he's from New York.
Hmm.
And that's all he would do. You know, he would every day make few sandwiches. He would go out and he would just smile at people and give them those sandwiches if he finds somebody who's in need of that act of kindness. And that's when once when he's in the suburb, he finds next to him one person comes and sits. I think he's come into the train to mug people. He's come with a knife or something like that. And when he comes to him, he just hands out a sandwich and he says, would you like to have a sandwich? Surprisingly, this man puts away the knife, sits next to Al Honig, and he eats that sandwich. And at the next stop, he just silently gets up and goes away. And just as he's leaving, he turns back and he says, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And I mean, as an individual, probably you'll never know what difference that is, that act has made in that person, right? But I'm sure that if you follow the life of that person, it would have made some kind of a change that you never know. First of all, it's just a random act of kindness. And secondly, you know, when you bring Swami into the picture, when you are doing it as your spiritual sadhana, the amount of goodness that it can do is immeasurable. You never can know. In fact, another beautiful story that we have so many times quoted is what happened when I think some devotees in Vizag or somewhere were doing this seva, where they would go to the railway station in that city and they would serve breakfast in the morning. The idea was there were these lot of you know, manual laborers would come, coolies who work in the railway station, a lot of people who come for daily labor. And they would come, turn up early in the morning, and they are the people who need that breakfast, and they are the people who never get to have breakfast. So this samiti took that as an activity. They would just go and serve breakfast, right? So when they were serving, one of the devotees had been to that city, so they also joined that seva. And while serving, they found that a very decent looking person came and took breakfast from there, right? Very well dressed. And we are always judgmental, you know. This is meant for poor people, and why is this man who seems to be able to afford this food coming and taking this food? So he turned to the sevadal who was serving next to him and says, why do such people also come and take breakfast? And then that sevadal with a smile said, why did you go and ask him? Why is he coming and taking food from here? So he said, no, how can I go and ask a person like that? He said, no, you go and ask him. Why is he coming and taking this food? So this person approached him and he said, why are you coming and taking this food, sir? We are serving it for poor people. And that person narrated the story. He said, you know, I was working in a good company, and because of the change in the market, job market, I lost my job. And I became very angry towards society, because I felt like I was a good person, I've never cheated anybody, and why should I be put through this? So he became antisocial because of that. He said, I'm not going to earn my, food anymore. I'll start stealing. That was his way of getting back at society. So he said, every morning I would dress up like this, I would come, and I started stealing from people, snatching bags and taking away purses and things like that. So he said that one day when I came to this region, to this area, I saw that these people were serving breakfast. And you see, this work is more demanding than the work I was doing in the office. So I was leaving office every day early, leaving home early every day, so I could not have breakfast at home. So I came across this counter and I said, hey, this is a good thing. I can come and have breakfast here. So this person who is listening to it must have thought that this is quite an anticlimax. That is, of course, the story didn't end there. So this person said, the first day I came and I took breakfast here, I go to the nearby bus stand and I'm standing there for my first victim. So he finds that an elderly man and a young girl come and stand in the bus stand. And he finds that they have just come from the bank and they have a bag in their hand. So everything is all set for him to, you know, take his payment for the day. So even as he was standing behind this man and this young girl, he hears the conversation that is happening. He realizes it's a father and a daughter. And the father is telling that, you know, your wedding is coming and with this all my responsibilities are over. So he kind of gets a picture of what is happening here. All his savings is there in that bag and he is performing the wedding of this daughter. And he said that I might have stolen from so many people, but that day somehow I did not have the heart to steal from this old man. So he goes away from the bus stand. Then he goes to another place and he is about to steal from another person and he thinks, I don't know what that person is going through. How important is this money to that person? I don't know. And he says, I went from place to place not able to steal. Because every time I was going to steal, this thought was coming. So he goes back home without having stolen from anyone. And even as he's sleeping that night, he's wondering, what did I do differently today that my mind has changed like this? And he said, the only thing I did was go and eat breakfast in that place where they were serving food. So he says that tomorrow I'll go and try it out again. Tomorrow again he comes, eats breakfast there, and he's not able to steal. Right? And then that leads to a transformation. Then he takes up another job, which paid him much lesser than his previous job. He says that, I'm not a devotee of Swami, but because of eating food here, I got good thoughts. So he says, Today, even though I have a job, I ensure I come and have breakfast here because I don't want my mind to change. Right? So when you do a random act of kindness, especially when you are doing it as seva, you have no idea what impact it is going to have on the other person, right? And that's why I think what he said here seems like a very simple poem, but Swami himself would say that. So many times Swami would say that, you know, just say Sai Ram to somebody, just say smile at the person whom you're coming across. You never know how far that is going to go.
And may this poem inspire us to make our random acts of kindness not so random. Right. It'd be nice if we can regularly do
habituate.
It. Yes, because as you said, having those having that food there itself brought in so much good thoughts, and it all begins with a thought. You know, a good thought can lead to a good word, which lead to a good deed. And Swami says, deeds lead to tendencies, tendencies become habits, habits become character, character becomes your destiny. It all starts with a thought. And I think that is what Shri K. Kondal Rao realized, because he has written an article in this edition of Sanatan Sarthi, which is called Good Thoughts. It's nothing but one dozen good thoughts. That's all it is. Very brief, very quick. It's so sweet and nice, and I think we can go one each. You know, the first good thought he says is, our daily duties are a part of our religious life just as much as our devotions are. Clearly, work is worship. You cannot be religious if you are being unprofessional and claiming that you are doing bhajans and satsang or whatever. So, work is worship. Our daily duties are as much part of our rituals, religious rituals, as our devotions are. That is the first good thought that he shares.
The second one that he writes is, to be angry is to revenge the fault of others upon ourselves. Something that is so important and we forget, right? Because when we get angry, most often we are not actually affecting the other person. It is something that eats us from within. You know, I mean, medically we know what all happens when we lose our temperature, that stress, what it does to our BP and all the other parameters inside. So it clearly is, especially when you have not done wrong, because righteous anger is something that we all go through at some point in time. Somebody is being bad, somebody is being nasty, and somebody is being cruel, but we become angry. It is like a punishment that we give to ourselves for somebody else being wrong.
In fact, it reminds me of a very sweet quote, which says, anger is an acid that damages the vessel in which it is stored more than the vessel into which it's poured.
Right.
And the third thing he shares is, let first things be put first. Work before play, duty before enjoyment, and others before self. This is an excellent rule which cannot lead you astray. To make a right beginning is halfway to victory. We all know well begun is half done, it is said. And so he says that generally in life, if we follow these principles, that let's work before play means let us do our duty before trying to enjoy. Duty before enjoyment, that's the next one. And others before self. These three we put into practice, we will never go astray. We will be right in whatever we do.
Right. The fourth point that he says is,
Actually, we can club the fourth and fifth together possibly. Yeah.
Okay. He says, character is not ready-made, but is created bit by bit, day by day. It's a very beautiful point that he has made, because this is one of the first lessons that you learn when you come to Swami. Right? We often, we are so obsessed with what we really are. But I think the first impact that Swami makes in us is that you create what you are, and that character is completely in your control, and you should take control over it. Right? And it has to be, again, going back to that little acts of kindness, that poem which spoke about, this is what it is. If you want to change it, it has to be changed brick by brick, bit by bit.
Even if we see that quote by Bhagwan, where he says that character leads to destiny, it starts with thought. You know, right. Thoughts are little things, and so many of those little things come together to become words, actions, tendencies, habits, and then character. So, Right. Yes. And the next good thought, you know, which he says, the secret in success is constancy in purpose. You know, it's about perseverance. It's about, while the previous good thought said that it's about the little things that do it, this thought says that those little things have to be done repeatedly with perseverance. Then only we achieve it. It's not, yes, like it is said that little things make up character, but if you just leave it, it's the little drops that make up the ocean, but five little drops don't make the ocean. There, you have to constantly keep putting those little drops to make up a big thing. So, on one hand, it is that small things are important. The other thing is, these small things, yeah, we have to do it constantly. As I said, let not random acts of kindness be random. Let us make them a disciplined way where we definitely do. We look out for opportunities to do these little things regularly.
The sixth point is, time hastens. Therefore, do today whatever kindly deed you may. right? Again, a point that Swami would often say, that if Swami would give the example of the conversation between Ravana and Lakshmana, right? Often the last moment when Ravana is about to die, Rama sends Lakshmana to him and he says, he's a great scholar, learn from him something and come. And that's when Ravana makes the statement. He says that, you know, if you have any good deed that you want to do, do it immediately. If there's anything bad that you want to do, try as much as possible to put it away for another day when you're able to think about it, right? So this is the sixth point that he makes. He says, if there's anything that you can, that you want to do good, try to do it immediately, because even when it comes to good, the mind changes, right? And that's the sixth point that he makes.
In fact, in Hindi they say, kal kare so aaj kare, aaj kare so ab, meaning what you want to do tomorrow, do today. What you want to do today,
do it now. Right.
The next one, he says, I think again we can combine the seventh and eighth. The seventh one is, the wear and tear of rust is faster than the wear and tear of work. The eighth one is, work is stimulus to work, loafing is stimulus to laziness. So, on one hand he says, work leads to further work being done, and lazing leads to further lazing. And he says that when you work, there is wear and tear, but when you laze, there is rust, because of which there is wear and tear. The wear and tear due to rust is more harmful than the wear and tear due to work. And I can not agree more with him, because, you know, I remember when this lockdown came, you know, we were literally shut in our homes, and I have a second-hand car, which is, yeah, decently old. Therefore, its battery is also decently old, but it was working absolutely fine. 4 months of not driving the car, the battery was dead. I couldn't even start the car. I had to replace it with a new battery. And it just made me realize that when the car is running, definitely the battery is getting used. But the wear and tear on the battery when the car is in use is much less compared to the wear and tear on the battery when the car is not being used. So as a practical tip during the lockdown, dear listeners, if you're keeping your car away, just unplug, disconnect the battery. Don't leave it connected, because 2 months if the battery is connected, it'll just drain out and it'll even die.
The old devotees who used to visit Prashant Nilayam in 50s and 60s, a few of them would have cars. And in those days, you can never come to Parthi with a plan. Right? Mm. They would come to Parthi, and whenever Swami permits them to leave, they would leave. So many times they would come with the idea that they'll be here for a couple of weeks, and they'll end up being here for 3 or 4 months. Mm. So one of those devotees had said that whenever he would bring a car, he had to park it in that slope behind the Ganesha temple. Hmm. Right? The slope remained. That time there was no Ganesha temple, but that slope was there, which leads to the Srinivasa guest house and the general hospital.
Right? Hmm.
So he would often park the car only in that slope, because invariably by the time he would take the car again, the battery would have died, and that way starting the car is easier. You know, you use the natural slope for the momentum. So that is the eighth point. It's a very, very important point. You know, the point, the thing that came to my mind while reading it is the reason why rust is more dangerous than, you know, the wear and tear that caused by work is, be it a car or be it any machine, it is made for work. And that which is made for work is better, is in a better state when it is being used for that.
Mm.
In the same sense, you know, Swami would say this body is made for karma. The more you do it, more you do karma, and karma in a certain manner, which Swami is of course told about duty and doing it as act of worship. The more it is done in that manner, the better it is for the body itself. And we've seen this. Today we are talking about sitting being the new smoking. You know, that's the you know, the phrase that they use. There's more harm done to the body by merely sitting than the act of smoking. You know, that's how much a sedative life has spoiled. Sedentary life has made our health bad, right?
And that's not to encourage smoking.
Right, that's not that's the thing. It's not even to encourage smoking.
And you know, the ninth one, again on similar lines, he says, every duty which is bidden to wait returns with 7 fresh duties at its back. A stitch in time saves 9, they say. Anything that is delayed or procrastinated only becomes more burdensome, more difficult to accomplish. You may think that I'll not do this one now, comes back. I think that is what is when he says that every duty which you procrastinate comes back as 7 fresh duties. That is why I think even in our college days, the way our day would be scheduled, every day you have to study 1 hour, and never are you allowed to study throughout the night. You have to sleep within 10, 10:30, maximum 11 o'clock, and you have to rise in the morning. So, unconsciously, Swami was inculcating in us that we do every day's study that day itself. You know, that is much more effective to study 1 hour every day, 1.5 hour every day, rather than just while away your time with anything else and then study for 8 hours on the stretch before the exams. So that's what it is. Every duty is easiest done when it is done in a timely manner and when it is supposed to be done, rather than delaying it, because by then it grows up into 7, 8 new tasks.
The next point he makes is, our anger and impatience often prove much more mischievous than the things about which we are angry or impatient. Again, an extension of a point that he made earlier, that the anger that we feel in us is more dangerous than the thing which is causing the anger, the problem or the issue that is causing the anger. I think it's valid enough to extend this to everything else, the stress and the worry and all that we feel.
The greed, the jealousy. Right. Yes, all the Arshad Vargas, I think.
Right.
The next 11th one, he says, down in their hearts, wise men know this truth. The only way to help yourself is to help others. I remember a very cryptic quote by the Dalai Lama,
mm-hmm.
where he says, be selfish, therefore be selfless. But I think that is what this quote is all about.
Right.
If you, a selfish person is supposed to be thinking only about his own good. And the Dalai Lama is saying there that if you genuinely want to keep thinking of your own good, you have to think of only others' good. That way he says, be selfish, therefore be selfless. And that's what he's saying here, that men know this truth, that the only way to help yourself is to help others.
Right. And the final point he makes is, kindness has the effect of balm. It soothes suffering, softens pride, dissipates selfishness, and exorcises bad temper. So again, a reference to the importance of kindness. And those are the 12 thoughts that he writes about in this article called Good Thoughts, K. Kondal Rao. I think even in the earlier issues, 3 or 4 articles have been written by him.
Yes, and dear listeners, let's allow these good thoughts to sink in us. And as they sink within us, we will take a quick little break, listen to this beautiful music, and come back after the break to conclude the satsang.
Kali Kali Maha Kali Kapalini.
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 Durga Durga Devi Durga Bhavani.
Durga Durga Kali Kapalini,
Durga Durga Devi,
పాలిని.
Welcome back, dear listeners. We have about another 15 minutes left for our afternoon satsang, and that's why we had to make a quick choice on what we will be covering now. There is another poem called Prayer by Yogiraj V.S. Bua in the September 1958 edition of the Sanatan Sarathi. Interestingly, in the next month's edition, which is October 1958 edition, there is an article by the same Yogiraj V.S. Bua called My Divya Darshan. It only makes sense that before we go to this poem, we actually read that. So we will be going to the October 1958 issue just for one article. After that, we'll return back to this poem that he has written called Prayer. So in the article titled My Divya Darshan, his first divine darshan that he had, Yogiraj Bua narrates how his first darshan of Bhagwan was on the 14th of March 1957. He had been invited to Venkatagiri for the 9th All India Divine Life Convention. You know, more about this is recorded in the Satyam Shivam Sundaram part 1, I think, yes. Part 1 or part 2. It's a chapter called From Cape to Kilanmarg. Cape to Kilanmarg, that's the chapter name. So it's recorded there. And the 9th All India Divine Life Convention happened at Venkatagiri. And Yogiraj Bua looks like he is a person who is accomplished as a yoga teacher. He had arrived there, and his first darshan of Bhagwan was on the morning of the 16th, when this convention was to begin. I think it was a 9-day convention. It appears like that. Mm-hmm. So on the 16th morning when it began, there was a golden palanquin that had been readied for Swami to be carried on the shoulders of people.
Oh.
All the sadhus and sannyasis from, I think, Rishikesh, Swami Shivananda Ashram mainly,
right,
and from all other parts of India had gathered there. Professor Kasturi records that they had come from even the East and West Godavari districts, from Hyderabad, from Madras, scholars, pandits, all had come for this Divine Life Convention. And this palanquin had been readied for a Swami who is much younger in age to many others. But as Yogiraj Bua writes in this article, he was also just waiting. He says that there is something magical in the whole atmosphere, whole environment. I was so eager. I wanted to have a look. I wanted to have a darshan and touch the feet of Bhagwan. And he says that 8:15 sharp, Swami came. But he just refused that golden palanquin. That golden palanquin had been bedecked with flowers of multiple colors and hues and fragrances. Swami just refused, and he said that all other sadhus are walking and I will walk along with them. So he was another orange-robed figure walking with all other orange-robed figures. And there was Yogiraj Bua seated, and Swami came to him, and he says that as Swami stood before him, he, like a bee attracted to the flower, he dived at Swami's feet, took Pad Namaskar, and Swami smiled at him and gave his Abhaya Hasta. He says that when Swami showed him the Abhaya Hasta, he felt like Swami was communicating to him, "Wife, here, when I'm here, I'll take care, you don't worry." It charged him so much, he was so thrilled with that. After that, Swami walked in. He didn't use the golden palanquin. This is very important to state here, because Swami Sachidananda, who was the keynote address, who gave the keynote address for the beginning of this Divine Life Convention, he actually made a reference to Swami refusing to go in the golden palanquin, because for a lot of media houses back then, you know, they used to think of Swami as somebody who has come to take wealth from the rich, and that's understandable in a sense, because all the kings and queens, all royalty would come to Bhagwan, and
right,
we have heard enough to know how it was that they were not given any special treatment because they were royalty. What mattered was the love and devotion in the heart. So there have been paupers who have been uplifted, there have been royalty who have been scorned, but without knowing it, a lot of newspaper articles and magazine articles were about Swami being like the Swamiji for the rich. And Swami Satchidananda was very moved, and he stated vehemently and strongly that this casual act where Swami said no and became one with us, he said that Swami, when he is with us, he is one with us. You know, Swami often has said that with a child, among children I am a child, with women I am a woman, with men I am a man, when I am by myself I am divine. And even the sadhus there felt it, that you know, Swami is also one among us. That is the magic that Swami has done. Anybody, the children feel that Swami is like a child with us. Everybody feels that Swami is one among us. That kind of universality only the divine can have. And he emphatically stated that and said that this single casual act should be enough evidence for all those people who are saying that he is for the rich. He said, I am personally convinced that Swami has no attraction towards any wealth, any of these things. He is here as a guiding force. He is here out of his selflessness and love. It is our greatest honor and privilege that Swami is attending this Divine Life Convention. And after that, you know, Bhagwan delivered his divine discourse.
Right. And I think there is a reference to that. This is from Satyam Shyam Sundaram, where, yes, you know, this is noted. The reference is as this, it goes, in his keynote address, Baba said, the divine life was the inspiration, the birthright, the motive force, the be-all and end-all of everything in creation, from microcosm to macrocosm. Divine life is the rain that falls from the clouds of truth, love and non-injury. It comprises all acts done in pursuit of reality. Baba says that the desire to attain reality or the divinity behind the elusiveness of material things is inherent and imminent in every individual as butter is in milk. Just as one churns milk to separate the butter, man must churn his mind with good deeds and good company. Between the eternal spirit and the evanescent world, the mind of man oscillates. Therefore, it is the duty of societies such as the Divine Life Society to fill the minds of its members with holiness and help in moving the dross of passion and lust. For this transformation, everyone is a worthy candidate, and the taste of that bliss is same for all. The society, Baba said, should endeavor with humility and equal love for all to further this process of transformation for as many as possible. It should strive to wipe out the root cause of anxiety, sorrow and ignorance. So I think this is the excerpt about the discourse. There is in Sathya Sai Speaks, that entire discourse is there, where Swami speaks about the Divine Life Society. Now, typically, like how he played with the word firestone and later about farmers, Swami also goes on to speak so much about divine life. You know, what is it? What is it to lead a divine life? There are beautiful messages directly meant for those who have taken to sannyasa, as well as for what it means to grihasthas who are trying to lead a divine life. Maybe we'll come to that when we come to that portion where Professor Kasturi writes about it. But it's a very beautiful period that the reference is made to, that divine life. We all know Swami Satchidananda, later his association with Swami. I think we've already spoken a little about Swami Satchidananda in one of the previous issues also, if I'm not wrong.
Definitely in a previous satsang we have spoken about Satchidananda.
Right. So later also, and that also is something that led to Swami going to Rishikesh, meeting Swami Shivananda. And in fact, the poem that he has written here, Yogiraj Bhua, is actually a prayer. It's an adaptation of a prayer written by Swami Shivananda. Now, if you go to Swami Shivananda Ashram in Rishikesh, you'll find that this is one of the prayers that they recite, devotees of, disciples of Swami Shivananda. So it's an adaptation of that, very beautifully worded. Maybe we'll read that out. So this is how the prayer goes. O adorable Lord of mercy and love, O the indweller of my bosom, the indweller of all beings, salutations and prostrations to Thee. Thou art Satchidananda, Thou art omnipresent, omnipotent and omniscient. Grant me an understanding heart, equal vision, balanced mind, faith, devotion and wisdom. Grant me inner spiritual strength to resist temptations, to control the mind, free me from egoism, lust, greed, and all its brood. Fill my heart with divine virtues, O Sanatana Sarathi.
He continues, My heart throbs to have thy glimpse again. Grant me my boon to serve thee, adorable Lord, ever at thy lotus feet, the Prashanti Nilayam. Else there lies no redemption to my soul. It's very interesting that he refers to Swami's lotus feet as Prashanti Nilayam.
Right.
That is the abode of supreme peace, his lotus feet. He continues, Let me behold thee in all these names and forms. Let me serve thee in all these names and forms. Let me ever remember thee, sing thy glories. Let me abide in thee forever and ever. This is the ardent prayer of this humble bhakta from Parshurama Kshetra. Prostrations unto thee, O Puttaparthi Baba. So, that is the poem by Yogiraj Bua. And we can understand where those feelings are coming from, because going back to that 1957 Venkatagiri All India Divine Life Convention, he says that on the 17th of March, he got the opportunity to deliver a speech. And along with that, he did a yoga demonstration. And I think at Radio Sai, we have a picture of a right. person doing this yoga demonstration. And most possibly, I think it is this Yogiraj Bua only. And that was his participation as a contributor in the Divine Life Convention. On the concluding day, you know, Professor Kasturi records in that chapter, Cape to Kilanmarg, that Swami gave an interview to each and every of those assembled sadhus and pandits. To each and everybody. There were, I think, definitely about 100 or 150 of them. And I think there's also a group photograph, possibly. I don't know if it's this convention or some other convention. But I have seen multiple group photographs of Swami with so many sadhus. But Swami spent time, and everybody, you know, this is a Divine Life Convention where all the greats from around the country have come. So it must be that each one wants to possibly, like, you know, it is the spiritual equivalent of these corporate meetings that we have where people try to build networking. But here everybody was interested in building up a rapport with Swami, because everyone wanted an interview with Swami. And Yogiraj Bua records that when he got his interview, Swami materialized for him a golden ring with Shirdi Sai and Parthi Sai. And then he says Swami materialized grapes and vibhuti.
Right.
And gave it to him. His thrill can be seen in the article that he writes. He says that it was his privilege to stay on in Venkatagiri till the 23rd of March. But then the blessings didn't end there. You know, Swami actually invited him to Prashanti Nilayam. And he says that he came to Puttaparthi. Actually, Swami, along with Swami, even Swami Sachidananda and Sadananda came. Mm-hmm. So Yogiraj Bua also came along with them. And he says that those days were so blissful. He would say it would begin with the Omkara Nada in the morning. I think it would be the Suprabhatam and Omkaram. After that, it would be bhajans. And he says daily darshan, daily bhajans. What else was needed? Added to this bhakti would be the wisdom and jnana that would flow from Bhagwan. You know, every day after bhajans, they would have discussions and interview sessions with Swami on the Prashanti Nilayam terrace. That's what he says. Every day on the terrace. And he says, this is what happened. And Swami even commanded him to go to the Bukkapattam school, the Sri Satya Sai Baba High School that we spoke about, I think, right. even during last week's satsang,
right.
of how Kasturi records that those
children were brought in.
So that school, Swami sent Yogiraj Bua to give a talk on yoga and also do a yoga demonstration there. You know, it just shows how, you know, just the same Swami, later on when any big shot would come, you know, from the industry or from anywhere, Swami would tell, go speak to my students in the moral class or their MBA class. And Swami was doing that back then also. And he concludes that article, you know, My Divya Darshan, that article he concludes with a most memorable Ramanavami day. So must be in March, he was at Venkatagiri. In April is when Ramanavami comes. So till then he's in Puttaparthi. He says, for the first time, Swami took all of them to the Chitravati sands, where Swami delivered a discourse on devotion, bhakti. And then, you know, he's so thrilled, fascinated, how Swami makes a small mound and from the tip of the mound pulls out a silver Shirdi Baba idol, which he gives it to a devotee, followed by an idol. It's not one idol, it's that, you know, like how we have at the Gopuram gate. Right. Rama, Lakshmana, Sita with Hanuman.
Right.
With that whole thing, that whole set Swami produces from the sand, gifts that to another devotee, and he says to top it all, the icing on the cake, the cherry on the icing of the cake was when Swami materialized a small container from the sands and waved and created a silver spoon and gave Amrit to everybody who had been present. He concludes the article with humble obeisance to Bhagwan, and he says that having found Swami, he has found everyone in life. In fact, he concludes with the poem, Tvameva mata cha pita tvameva, tvameva bandushcha sakha tvameva, tvameva vidya dravinam tvameva, tvameva sarvam mama deva deva. With that's how Yogiraj Bua concludes his article, and it's so nice that we know his background, and then we understand why he has written such a poem of feeling, of love, and of surrender to Swami.
So those were the articles of the 1958 September issue. We've not completed all of them. I think one or two might be remaining. So the next time we come back to this series of Sanatan Sarathi, we'll do those articles. So dear listeners, with that, we'll conclude this week's Afternoon Satsang. We're going to leave you with a bhajan. On the other side of it, we'll have the Veda Jignasa program and the others to follow. Just a reminder, this evening we have a special satsang talk by Mr. Sanjay Sahni, the controller of examinations of our university here, a lecturer, former lecturer from the Brindavan campus and the director. He's been a very inspirational teacher to all of us. So that is the special satsang for this Thursday. That'll be at 7:30. You can tune into our YouTube channel if you would like to see that as a video. We will join you again next week for the afternoon satsang on the Conversations with Bhagwan, that series which we go to every fortnight. We leave you with this bhajan. Till we meet you next time, take care. Jai Sai Ram.
Adi Ananda Sagala Sanatana.